Hush. Somebody's calling my name. Somebody's calling my name. Oh, my Lord, what shall I do? The song hints at this inner restlessness and maybe trepidation, something, a little bit of anxiety we feel when we know that we must do something. When we feel a constellation of circumstances and inward potential coming together and pulling us into facing something or undertaking something, changing something, becoming something we want to become, or fulfilling something we believe we are meant to fulfill. In the story of David and Goliath, the armies of the Philistines and the Israelites are camped on two hills with a plain in between them. Every day, Goliath, the Philistines' champion warrior, stalks out toward the Israelite army. And some early texts make Goliath about 6 feet, 9 inches, which is impressive today and would have been much more so in his time. The text that comes to us in the Greek Bible that we use, his height is exaggerated by scribes who wanted to heighten the drama, putting him at about 9 feet. But let's just say he's a towering, scary guy. And the text says, Goliath had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of bronze scale armor, weighing 5,000 shekels. And on his legs he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. Now, shekels are a little bit like yen. It sounds like a lot. An iron spear point weighing 600 shekels converts in our systems to about 15 pounds, which admittedly is still a pretty big spear point. So Goliath is intimidating. He's frightening. He's decked out in the most impressive gear available. He's a braggart and a bully. And every day he taunts the Israelites, challenging them to send out their best warrior to face him and laughing at them when they fail to do it. His belittling insults get under their skin. And the king of the Israelites, Saul, becomes increasingly paralyzed. He cannot mobilize himself or his army to act. For 40 days this goes on. And the longer it goes on, the more deflated the Israelites become, the more unable to move. When David sees how demoralized the Israelite army has grown, and what an insult Goliath's defiance is to his people and to his God, he immediately begins to itch. You can practically see him fidgeting with his slingshot, thinking about the bear and the wolf that he brought down, each with a single shot. And although he's too young to be a soldier, he finds any excuse to linger at the camp with the men, questioning them about the giant and about King Saul's plans. He becomes a gadfly and an annoyance. His older brothers tell him to get lost, calling him foolish and irresponsible to have left the sheep, and calling him conceited to imagine that this situation has anything to do with him. This is but the business of men, not little boys and wannabes. And the defiant teenager, David, says, now what have I done? I can't even speak. It's right in the text. And he turns away from them and he asks someone else the same question, keeps engaging the soldiers. But eventually his eagerness comes to the attention of King Saul, who sends for him and gives him a hearing. Now David knows that he is called to face Goliath. Whether anyone else knows it, whether anyone else can recognize it, he knows it. He knows it in his guts, in his muscles, and in his twitchy fingers. He seemed to have a feeling about it right away. And who knows, maybe that little pebble that he put in his slingshot was having a similar experience. Maybe it awakened in the night, sensing that it was about to have a consequential meeting with a giant's forehead, and that somehow it would play a crucial role in the history of a people. Sometimes there's great clarity about this calling. Sometimes it's just a barely audible hint of a whisper, which is why the song says, hush, hush. If we don't get quiet inside, if we don't get some space from all the other voices around us and inside us, yelling their opinions, yelling their bad advice, is Mary Oliver's poem, about who we are or what we should and shouldn't be doing, if we don't get some space from that, we won't be able to hear that whisper. The Bible's full of stories of such callings, callings that often make little sense to the person who receives it, much less sense to the people around them. The calling of Moses to be the leader of his people out of slavery. Moses, a criminal on the lam, a guy who is easily tongue-tied, who falls into stammering and stuttering when he's nervous, is supposed to stand up to Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world. Yeah, right. The calling of the little boy Samuel in the night. He hears a voice calling his name. It wakes him up three times. And each time he thinks it's his father calling him, and he gets out of bed and goes to his father. And twice his father says, what are you doing? It's the middle of the night. Go back to bed. But the third time, his father, Eli, realizes that something important is happening, that it's Yahweh calling his son, calling him to a purpose. And the great irony of this story is that the truth that young Samuel has to bear witness to is that his father and his father's house, the house of Eli, is going to be destroyed, brought down because of the sins that have been committed. And it's Samuel's job at that very tender age to deliver this news to his own father. And he becomes a prophet in his life. And then there's the calling of the prophet Elijah, who's told to go to the mountainside and wait for God to come to him. And there he witnesses this powerful wind and an earthquake and a fire, this fantastic phenomenon. But he knows that that's not the voice of God. And finally, after all of the tumult ceases, subsides, when everything becomes very calm, very quiet, he hears the voice. He hears the still, small voice that questions him. What are you doing here, Elijah? And then gives him his calling, his guidance. And there's the calling of Jonah. So God commands Jonah to proclaim repentance to the people of Nineveh before calamity falls upon them. And this is a summons that Jonah goes to great lengths to ignore and avoid. In his efforts to get as far away as possible from this very uncomfortable thing that he's supposed to do, he takes a ship bound for the city of Tarshish, a city which he heard is very nice, very pleasant this time of year, and which happens to be in the opposite direction of the city of Nineveh. And on the way, there's a storm, and Jonah is thrown overboard and swallowed by the great fish. And the fish eventually regurgitates him up on the shore of what land? Nineveh. And there's the calling of Mary to bear and raise the Messiah of her people. When the news of this comes to her and strange things begin to occur and strange pronouncements are made, she treasures it all up in her heart and ponders it there and says very little to anybody. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes it takes a great deal for us to overcome our fear of stepping toward the thing that we must do. One of my favorite stories about Martin Luther King Jr. is the story of a moment of despair. The Montgomery bus boycott is underway, and he's been thrust reluctantly into the role of leader and spokesperson, and he's been receiving terrible, hateful mail and phone calls and violent threats against his life. And one night, it's January 27th, 1955, just about now. A date that would stand out forever for him. That night he comes home from a mass meeting, a meeting held in the church where there's singing and there's preaching and strategizing and rallying. But he comes home utterly exhausted and deeply, deeply anxious. He's at the end of his inner resources, and he's alone in his kitchen, And he gets one of those phone calls, those hateful, violent, just stunningly cruel and mean phone calls. And it gets under his skin. It gets to him. And he's pacing in his kitchen, and he sits at the kitchen table, and he gets up and paces again, and then he slumps at the table with his head in his hands, his cup of coffee getting cold. And he realizes that he can't tell anybody. He can't say to anybody, let anyone know how doubtful he is, how terrified. And he feels totally alone. But he starts to pray out loud in his kitchen. He starts to pray and he starts to cry. He says, "Oh Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. But Lord, I must confess, I am weak. I'm afraid. Oh Lord, the people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they will falter. Lord, I'm at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I cannot face it alone." And there he is, sitting with his head in his hands, crying. And at that moment, in that hush, he hears it. Or he feels it. It's hard to know which it is, but it's that whisper. It's rising up out of the calm, clear presence within him. The presence that's inside but larger than himself. And it tells him, "Martin, stand up. Martin, stand up for righteousness. Martin, stand up for justice. And I will be with you always. And I will never leave. I will never leave you. I will never leave you alone." Well, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was already a renowned preacher and pastor at that time, but he forever marked that day as his day of conversion, where he came to know the divine not as a belief, but as an actual power within himself. And yet, even with this conversion, this calling, even with the exceptional courage and conviction and vision and leadership and action with which he is publicly remembered, Martin Luther King remained a very human, very flawed, and very troubled person. He suffered terribly with the weight of the responsibility that he carried. He would fall into periods of morbid preoccupation with his death. He had his vices, his self-destructive behaviors, his self-deceptions and deceptions of others, and his inner torments. And I think it's important to remember this because we can imagine that he was so amazing that it wasn't hard for him to be so brave, to be so driven, and to be such a visible object of the public's attention, both as a target of hatred and as an icon of idealization. But it was incredibly hard. It was unimaginably hard for this very human man. And he needed every shred of every resource and every bit of help available to him to keep going toward what he was called to do. Spiritual faith, community, friends, family, advisors, the confidence of the people he was leading, song and celebration of victories, solitude, release, and spiritual faith again. All of these things helped him to be courageous, to be David facing Goliath. We might imagine that once the calling comes, it's easy. We just go out and do it, whatever it is. But it's not easy. It's not easy the way it's described in the myth of David, the one-shot wonder. Victoria Safford, in her piece, The Map of the Journey in Progress, she speaks about the landmarks of conversion, and landmarks plural. She tells us how growing into ourselves, how becoming stronger and braver is a slow, difficult, many-staged process. And we learn from each risk that we take that doesn't kill us. And we learn from each setback we experience that doesn't kill us. And we learn from every difficult and fearsome and bewildering experience that happens to us, and every small step we take that moves us slightly in the right direction. These are the tiny increments of conversion, the landmarks. When I say conversion, we're talking about an unfolding of our true potential. I just came across an interesting quote from Henry James, who was an early observer of the spiritual dimensions of psychology in the Western tradition. And he writes, "Keep the faculty of effort alive in you by little gratuitous exercises each day, every day. That is, be systematically ascetic, i.e. self-denying, or heroic, that is brave, in little unnecessary points, and do every day or two something for no other reason than you would rather not do it, so that when the hour of dire need draws nigh, it may find you not unnerved and untrained to stand the test." So moral courage is not just a voice within, nor is it a gift or simply a gift. It is a muscle that needs to be exercised. I remember when someone explained to me that Rosa Parks' act of civil disobedience was not simply a momentary inspiration, but that she had trained in civil disobedience with her community. She was ready to take that on when the moment came. So moral courage is a muscle that needs to be exercised. And we have to practice meeting our call in tiny ways, going out beyond ourselves in small things so that we can do it in more significant ways when they present themselves. So right now, we're going to do a very small, very tiny bit of calisthenics. So I invite you, if you would like, to close your eyes and turn within. And ask yourself if there's something that you feel you are called to do or to be. Is there a constellation of circumstances or an inward potential that's pulling you toward facing something, undertaking something, changing something, becoming something you want to become, or fulfilling something you are meant to fulfill? Now, don't feel dejected if you aren't in touch with that feeling right now, because we each have our individual timing. We're all in very different places in our lives. We all have our cycles to our own unfolding. And we each feel the pull forward in different ways, sometimes more as a kind of stick than a carrot. But turn within and ask yourself if there is something calling you. And you can keep your eyes closed if you wish. But if you're aware of feeling called, of that little voice, the feeling inside that's beckoning or prodding, take a moment to be with it. And if you are ready, stand up.